Iran, Israel, are they on the verge of war? What does it mean for the Middle East?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Yeah, you talk about the right day for thoroughly Jewish Thursday. So much happening in the Middle East. Monday is the day of the official moving of our embassy. Just a few days ago, President Trump pulls out of the Iran nuclear deal, and in doing so, sparks a harsh reaction from Iran. And then, just within the last 24 hours, Iran, which is entrenched in Syria, tries to bomb Israel. Israel retaliates strongly. Israel basically said, you don't want to mess with us. How far is this going to go? We'll talk about that today on The Line of Fire and much more. Michael Brown, welcome to the broadcast. 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-348-7884. And as always, on Thursdays, if you have Jewish-related questions, give me a call, 866-348-7884. With any Jewish, Israel, Hebrew-related question, my joy to do my best to be of help to you. All right, headlines. Let's look at this first headline. Multiple blasts heard in Golan Heights after reports of Israel strike. This is one of many headlines. Let me read it again. Multiple blasts heard in Golan Heights after reports of Israeli strike. So here's what happened. Iran is intensifying its position in more deeply entrenching itself in Syria. And from there wants to attack Israel. Iran has long helped to underwrite Hezbollah, based in Lebanon or Syria, and from there trying to attack Israel. The Golan Heights, the northernmost border leading up to Syria. And before Israel took that at great cost in the midst of war a few decades back, before they did that, this is a place easily where terror attacks could be carried out. You could just snipe down from the Golan Heights to the people of Israel. So this is a key part of Israel's security. So Iran is going to threaten Israel now. Basically, Israel and America looked at as working together here. So there were some attempted missile strikes, no harm done in terms of loss of life or anything like that. But Israel went into Syria with their air force and bombed Iran heavily. You say, well, what do you mean bombed Iran and Syria? I'm talking about the Iranian bases in Syria. I'm talking about the Iranian strongholds in Syria. I'm talking about Iranian airfields with Iranian-funded planes and weaponry. And according to Israel, they pushed things back months. In fact, let me read this to you. Oh, where is this? Hang on. I had it up in front of me, and I just got rid of it. Some really interesting quotes here. Israel bombards Iranian targets in Syria. More than 50 sites hit, setting back Iran months. So listen to what Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman said. Israel had destroyed, quote, nearly all of Iran's military infrastructure in Syria, and the IDF said Iran had been set back many months. So according to the Times of Israel, Lieberman said this, if we get rain, you will get a flood. He warned Iran, speaking at the annual Herzliya conference. We will not let Iran use Syria as a base to attack us from. The Iranians tried to attack the sovereign territory of Israel, Lieberman said. Not one Iranian rocket landed in the state of Israel. Nobody was hurt. Nothing was damaged. And we're to be thankful for that. We damaged nearly all of the Iranian infrastructure in Syria. But where is this going to go? How far will this go? Will there be an all-out conflict between Iran and Israel? I want to say plainly that I do not have some secret inside information. I do not have some source within the Israeli government or some mole in the Iranian government who's reporting back so that I can tell you things that others don't know. I cannot tell you that the scriptures explicitly say that such and such a conflict will happen at such and such a time. And I cannot say that the Holy Spirit has given me special insight at this moment. What I can tell you is my general sense, and you can just take it for what it's worth. I don't see an all-out escalation of hostilities right now because I don't think Iran can afford to do it. What do I mean? Iran and America are not in a good place right now relationally. But Iran also knows that hit with massive sanctions, with a massive economic downturn, with real hardship for the Iranian people, that it will be very difficult to hold down revolt and dissent, especially when the Iranian people, to the extent they were able to hear or read President Trump's speech earlier this week, they understand we have an ally in America. If we push back against the government, Donald Trump is telling us we are not alone. All right, let's go a little further. If Iran wants to strike Israel, and you're talking about something that could be an all-out war, terrible, terrible numbers of casualties, even if Israel wins the war, and then God knows how many casualties within Iran itself. But Iran has to know that Israel would not be fighting alone, that if Iran attacked Israel, Iran would now have to deal with war, not just with Israel, but with America. So is it possible that things are about to explode? It could be. I just don't sense it's at that point yet. Will there be future upheaval of massive proportions? Yes. Do I sense it's about to happen? No. I'm just giving you my sense of things. Now, I want to read some quotes to you. Got this in an email from Magen David Adom, it's like the Israeli Red Cross. It's the Israeli Red Star of David, ambulatory help, emergency help, and things like that. And they were saying, look, there could be a real war here with Iran. We need your help. They're just talking about medical help and donations and things like that in the case of war. But look at some of these quotes from Iranian leaders and General, and I'm sure I'm going to mispronounce some of the names, General Abdul Rahim Mousavi, Commander-in-Chief of Iran's army. Our fingers are on the trigger, and the missiles are ready to fire. We need to prevent this illegitimate entity, namely Israel, from continuing to exist even one more day. Brigadier General Hossein Salami, Iran's second-in-command. All of Israel is within range of our weapons, including Air Force bases, so do not depend on them. Israel has nowhere to run. It is living in the dragon's mouth. Here's another, Mohsen Rezai, Iran's Expediency Council Secretary. Tel Aviv will be razed to the ground. And then Ali Shiraz, Iranian senior official. Iran has the ability to obliterate Israel, and given the excuse, it will turn Tel Aviv and Haifa into dust. And then Brigadier General Kumaraz Hedari, commander of the Iranian ground forces. The date has already been set for the destruction of Israel. Now, I don't have exact dates on those quotes, but what I can tell you is that these quotes absolutely reflect the hostile feelings of Iranian Islamic leaders toward Israel. They look at Israel as illegitimate. They look at Israel as an enemy that must be exterminated from the land, and they would gladly take part in doing it. And they are funding and directly involved with a lot of the instability in the land. And even to this day in countries like Iraq, where Americans still die, and when there is still battle between Shiite and Sunni Muslims, and Muslims dying at the highest percentage of any in terms of numbers. So highest rate of any, I should say. Iran is behind a lot of that. Iran is behind a lot of the funding of those activities. So it remains, yes, truly the chief exporter of terror in the world. And Israel remains its arch enemy. And yes, Iran has called America the great Satan, and some of it to our shame because of the junk that we export around the world, again, to our shame. But America has been called the great Satan by Iran, and Israel is the little Satan. My friend Rabbi Shmuley has an editorial, and he has praised President Trump in loud and clear terms for his breaking with the disastrous Iran nuclear deal. And he says this, President Donald J. Trump has rid America of the shame of the Iran nuclear deal, which completely overlooked all of Iran's sins. In doing so, he has created the potential for reining in the rogue regime in Tehran, curbing the ascendance of radical Islamists, and advancing a foreign policy that recognizes evil and holds belligerent governments accountable. Simultaneously, Trump has emerged as a great champion of the Jewish people and a protector of Israel. Shmuley says the Iran deal was traumatic because it was catastrophic. It allowed the Iranians to pocket billions of dollars to finance terrorism, $150 billion, ballistic missile development, and intervention in its neighbors' affairs in exchange for biding its time before building nuclear weapons. Shmuley writes, Obama promised Iran's behavior would change, but instead it got worse and escalated threats to American interests. President Barack Obama ignored Iran's lies and threats in search of a foreign policy achievement to attach to his legacy. Now, whatever President Obama's motivation was, Shmuley gives you his viewpoint. Even if his motivation was best, even if his motivation was altruistic, even if his motivation was, hey, this is what's going to be good for Israel, for Iran, for the world, it was a sellout of a deal. It was one that went forth without congressional approval. My friend Al Perotta, writing at The Stream, has a list, maybe I'll get to that later, a list of everything that President Obama did to get that deal pushed through. And it is a fine thing, a good thing, a right thing that President Trump has undone it. I could care less who's Republican, Democrat. I could care less color of people's skins. I could care less other ideologies. I'm saying what President Obama did with the Iran deal was wrong. What President Obama did in breaking our part of it was right. And did the Iranian parliament burn our flag in its session as a result? We'll be right back. Shake the nation, change the world. Change the world. God of light, hear our cry. Send the fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, I forgot we had our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday music, but it jumped dancing in my ear. Great to be with you. Here's the number to call, 866-348-7884. If you have a Jewish-related question of any kind, it can be related to the Hebrew Scriptures, it can be related to Messianic prophecy, it can be related to Jewish tradition, the situation with Israel today, 866-348-7884 is the number to call. Okay, interesting story, and let's see. This is as reported in the Jerusalem Post. Azealia Banks, rap star, yes. I only became familiar with her name maybe last year when she had some extremely vulgar comments that were made to Sarah Palin, but she's obviously very well known in her circles. So she went to perform in Israel. Now, from the little I've read about her songs, she wouldn't be the type of person I'd be listening to. But many, many entertainers, many celebrities will not perform in Israel because of the push to boycott Israel and because of Israel being demonized. So more power to her for going over. That's great. I'm glad she did. But after being there, and she deflected criticism while there, but after being there, she said, I will never, ever go to Israel again. She said she got rude treatment after a concert in Tel Aviv. So let's just look at this. She said, I will never, ever, ever, ever go to Israel again. She tweeted this on Tuesday. I love my fans, but you're all going to have to fly out to come see me because y'all country is nuts. And she even tweeted out that Jews run the world, that they've got the entertainment industry and the sports industry in their back pocket. And initially, while there, she defended Israel. She got criticism about being in Israel, and she said, y'all forget that there are black and brown people in Tel Aviv living their lives, going to work, minding their own business, streaming music on Spotify, listening to my random rants, who are really happy that I came to play where they could access me. This is on Monday. My concert is a place where people can just be human beings without all the politics. And when some followers made the bogus charge that Israel is an apartheid state, she replied that the United States of America is a white supremacist country. Can't condemn another country without first examining yourself. But what happened to change her tune? And of course, she's got strong views about America. She said, I love my fans, but the people in Tel Aviv are really very rude. She tweeted this on Tuesday. The folks at the hotel, in restaurants, at the grocery store, treated me with such disregard, I really didn't enjoy my time there. The show was great, though. She said she didn't get paid enough to put up with the social culture in Israel and would only come back for some real money. And then she wasn't happy with her treatment while flying home. The people at security deliberately took extra long to search my things, clearly because I am black, she said. I had an escort with me and everything. They still held me up while I watched a bunch of white folk move past me quickly and get to their gates on time. She added that the woman on her flight screamed at her about her carry-on bag. It was so racist, I sat in my seat and cried. Okay, as someone who's been to Israel many a time, is it true that sometimes Israelis are rude? Yep, it's true. Israelis can be rude. Israelis can be pushy. Israelis can be aggressive. Here, look at it like this. All of you listening that grew up in New York City or New York City suburbs, and then you move, say, to Alabama or Mississippi, you find a very different culture, don't you? You find a very different world. To this day, even though I've been out of New York almost half my life, right? So born in 1955, moved to Maryland in 1987 with our family. Nancy born and raised on Long Island, me born in New York City, raised on Long Island. So we spent our first 32 years roughly in New York, Long Island area, and then the last 31 or so in different states outside of New York. Fact is, I still have a strong New York personality. I still can be more pushy and aggressive. I still have to be very careful if there's a tight flight and I'm not getting the right answers at the check-in counter, not to be too aggressive. Those are things I have to deal with. And yeah, it's true. Israelis are called sabras. Sabra, speaking of a cactus-like plant there that's prickly on the outside but soft on the inside. Israelis will die for each other, be very caring for each other. But you want to talk about Israeli traffic and honking of horns and people being aggressive and pushy? I remember my first time in Israel, we're at baggage claim, and one guy pushed in front of another lady to grab his luggage as it came by, and she shoved him as he walked away, and I thought, yeah, welcome to Israel. So the Israelis may be rude, and maybe that surprised Azealia Banks. And are there Israelis who are racist and haven't treated Ethiopian Jews properly? Yeah, there has been some of that, but of course there's been a national pushback against that. It's been considered outrageous and wrong. And in point of fact, Israel is a melting pot. Israel is an absolute cultural melting pot. People from all kinds of backgrounds live in Israel and are part of the larger community of Israel, including different religions. What about security? Was she specially targeted because she was black? I seriously doubt it. was she targeted? You know how many times I coming back from Israel by way of France? I believe that was it. On El Al, I think it was coming back with my assistant Dylan. Going in either way, we got pulled aside, and it was probably about 45 minutes or longer that we got grilled and questions. They separated us. They compared our answers. They went back and forth and talked to each other. I was loving it because I wanted Dylan to feel the full weight of El Al security procedures. And we were both smiling. And they were like, why are you smiling? I thought it's just so fun to see you do your job. And that because our ministry, what are you doing here? Why, who and how and every possible question and answer. So Dylan, how long have you known him? So you know him well? Well, yeah, it works for me. I've been to his house. No, not in the house. Just dropped him off sometimes after an airport trip or et cetera. Oh, and then they'd go and ask him and they'd come, okay, your answers are lining up. Anything they see that gets them questioning things. Trust me, if you have a Muslim name, if you look Arabic, and if there's anything suspicious in your travel patterns, yes, there is profiling. That's what they do. They look for cases that are more likely to be dangerous because they are under threat 24/7 from every angle. So if there's something comes up, or if you don't answer the right way, if you push back a way they don't like, everything instantly escalates. Everything instantly escalates. So that is why they are so well trained, and that's why they have virtually cut out terrorism after having terrible incidents of it. And that's what we've tried to get our TSA and others to learn from and say, hey, there are right ways to do things, but you have to have highly trained people. And the moment you begin talking to them, everybody gets a little nervous. You feel the tensions rise, and you're answering the right way and body language. They're looking at all that. In years past, when I used to travel with a breathing machine, CPAP machine, because of sleep apnea. So flying overseas, I had one that I could actually use with battery power. Or if I'm in business class, I can plug it in. And then I used to just, lay down in the seat as much as I could, put the blanket over my head. Just a little bit embarrassing, but I slept better with it. So I needed it while traveling. Otherwise, I wasn't going to sleep properly. And I remember one time, never, ever had a problem coming back from Israel one time. The security guy just did not feel at home with it. And explained the need for it. The whole bit, he goes, no, I just don't feel good about it. He brought over someone else. They then dialogue with me further. Ultimately, they said, sorry, you have to check it in your luggage. I said, but I need it on the flight. They said, sorry. I said, but it's an expensive piece of equipment. I can't just check it. So they wrapped it in all this plastic and, that's round and round and round. And we figured out a way to get it. They brought my luggage out. We put it in there. I've had probably a half dozen times, maybe three of them, that were really intense and long and waiting. And that's what they do. Jewish believer in Jesus or, what are you doing? So this can just happen. This can just happen. To now make it an indictment on Israel. So Ms. Banks, I understand why you could feel targeted and think it was because of your race. Trust me, if there's the least bit of noncompliance or the least bit of I'm special, or the least bit of something just not properly fitting what they're looking for, you're going to be questioned. But don't get upset about it. That's why it's so safe to travel there. Yeah, you get on an El Al flight going to Israel, or you have Israeli security on other flights. Take my word for it. You feel more secure on those flights than any. All right, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. You've got Jewish-related questions. We've got answers. Phone lines are open, and we will be right back. Some special announcements. Need your prayer support as well. Stay tuned.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thank you for joining us on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown. We're about to go to your phone calls with your Jewish-related questions. Here's the number to call, 866-348-7884, 866-34-TRUTH. All right, before I do that, please give me your best ear for the next couple of minutes, all right? For many years, going back, couple of decades plus, I had it on my heart to go on a particular New York City radio station, one that blankets the city, a Christian station, but blankets the city, and do a Jewish outreach radio show. 1 hour, one night a week, just for Jewish outreach. Now, for years, we were on this station during the day, for several years, from around, 2011 to, till fairly recently. We were on this station 5 days a week, Thursday, Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, but it's not, our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday show is more informative than specifically Jewish outreach. And then we ultimately had to get off being on 5 days a week in New York City. God has provided the funds for 1 year of Jewish outreach in New York City. All right? We're going to be shooting out an email talking more about this, giving the details, telling folks when it's going to start, how they can tune in. Now, when I say provided the funds, I mean for airtime. But we have a lot of other needs to get this going, to get up and running, and to make it so it is totally user-friendly for folks who are listening to be able to contact us so that we can help them come to know Jesus, Yeshua, the Messiah. And I know over the years that we have had many listeners in New York. So here's where we need your help. First, pray that God would use us effectively to reach New York's 2+ million Jews. In terms of a concentration of Jewish people, it's the largest concentration in the world. That's the first thing. Pray with us for anointing, for wisdom, for the right approach, for people to tune in and listen. We're going to be getting all of our Christian friends, different Jewish ministries in New York to help get the word out, tell their Jewish friends, hey, tune in and listen, and we're looking for other ways to get it out. We're looking to be able to take video that we'll do during the radio show that will be great tools that we can put online for others as well. And we need your support. If you could help with a one-time gift at this point, it would really be a great blessing to us. If we're blessing you on a daily basis with the radio show, if you love Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, hey, we're only on the air because people give to support. That's the only way we're on the air. But if you could help with a one-time gift of any size, just pray, and if you could be generous to sow into Jewish ministry, even ask yourself, how often do you get to give directly into Jewish ministry? It would be a great shot in the arm for us now and of great help. So to stand with us, go to askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. Click on donate, and you'll be able to help. Again, your one-time gift will be a real shot in the arm now as we prepare to launch Jewish outreach one night a week throughout New York City, reaching 2+ million Jews, potentially. I'm just talking about those that will be in our listening range. And what an amazing open door. And God has provided for the airtime, so we're asking you to stand with us and help us as we push forward in this regard. Again, go to AskDrBrown.org, click on donate, and pray for us as well, that God would give us grace to see many Jewish people come to know Jesus, Yeshua, the Messiah. All right, with that, we go to the phones. We'll start in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Gary, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
And I'm also just going to let you know, I'm really looking forward to the first online mentoring session tonight. Really jazzed.
Awesome. Glad you'll be part of it, sir.
So my question is around circumcision and God giving a circumcision to Abram and saying it would be on the eighth day for every child. I was actually leading one of our home groups last night, and we were in Romans 4 talking about Abram's faith being counted to him as righteousness, and then the order of that was circumcision. And one of the ladies in the study asked, what was the significance of the eighth day? And I said, honestly, I said, I don't know. I've never dug into that. But I tell you what, tomorrow is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. I'm going to call Dr. Brown and ask him. So I was wanting to see what you would have to say about that.
Sure thing. Gary, to the best of my knowledge, we have to speculate as to why it was the eighth day. In other words, a Christian might immediately think, well, eighth day, that signifies resurrection, but there's no evidence that that thinking would be there in Abraham's day. That's one. And two, circumcision is not an act of resurrection. Some have simply said that in terms of blood coagulating, that from a medical viewpoint, that would be the best day to do it for a newborn, and God, in his wisdom, picked it for that day. Beyond that, it's a matter of speculation. It's not like there was a custom in the ancient world to do it on the eighth day. That being said, what is important is to recognize that circumcision was not just practiced by the people of Israel. It was practiced in the land of Canaan, and it was a way of God joining his people, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and their descendants, with those in the land of Canaan. It was a rite that tied in with the land, which is why, for example, the Philistines, who were not native Semitic peoples, who were called Sea peoples, and who came in and settled in the southwest coast, which is now Gaza Strip, the southwest coast of Israel, they were called uncircumcised Philistines because that was abnormal. Those living in the land, and Egypt practiced it as well, practiced circumcision. So that's the interesting thing. It was not so much a new innovation as much as new for people coming into that area, but it was a way that actually joined them with the land. And then you have imagery from there about removing the foreskin and circumcise the foreskin of your hearts, like Deuteronomy 10 or Deuteronomy 30, those kind of images. But that's a secondary spiritual image from there.
Sure.
Beyond that, if I discover anything about the eighth day, I will let you know, all right?
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Sure thing. God bless. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Los Angeles. Anne, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you. I have a question about Jewish belief, like common current Jewish belief. I encountered in a group of friends of mine who are Reformed Jews this attitude that when Adam and Eve ate from the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, that wasn't actually a bad thing, that there was nothing evil about that. And then I noticed that Dennis Prager the other day said something similar, like, oh, you know, the world is, we've learned so much and we've experienced so much because they ate of that fruit. And I thought, is that common for Jewish people to think that that was not a bad, evil thing to do, to disobey God?
Yeah, as far as Dennis Prager's comments, I'd have to look at them in larger context, because Dennis Prager is a conservative Jew, but with more of an Orthodox view of Scripture. He would look at Scripture as being more inspired than a typical Reform or conservative Jew. Yet he would still have quite a few liberal ideas and insights. So I'd have to look at that. He sent me a copy of his Exodus commentary that just came out, but Genesis is still to come. So I'd have to wait for that or find his comments in context. But what's interesting with your Reform friends, who are not to be confused with Reformed Christians, who are more conservative in their views. A Reformed Jew is very liberal. A Reformed Jew is going to be pro-abortion. A Reformed Jew is going to welcome, say, a lesbian rabbi, etc. And a Reformed Jew is not going to look at Scripture the same way we do. So, number one, do your Reformed friends believe that Adam and Eve actually existed? They read the text more symbolically to start. So for them, they're going to put a totally different slant on it. Their views do not represent the views of traditional Judaism. Now, that being said, traditional Judaism doesn't see, quote, the fall exactly the same as we would see it, so that it wouldn't see, for example, the whole human race falling in Adam and now everyone being damned because of that, or with an innate sinful nature. They would see every human being with what's called the two inclinations, Yetzer HaTov and Yetzer HaRa, the good inclination and the evil inclination. and you have a lifelong battle to subdue the evil inclination through the good inclination. But they would certainly say that there was a terrible fall. For example, in rabbinic literature and homiletical literature, the Midrash, it paints pictures of Adam being absolutely giant. He could stride over the whole earth in just a few strides. And he just glowed like the sun. And so he was almost this superhuman being. And then after they sinned and after they ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, then they became mortal in the fullest sense of the word and died like everybody else. And there's even a rabbinic reading of Genesis 3 where Adam confesses, yeah, the woman you gave me, she gave me the tree. And not that I ate, but I eat. In other words, it is an ongoing thing I am doing because of the sin that I committed. But certainly traditional Judaism would look at this as sinful and wrong. Remember, traditional Judaism is based on observing the commandments. It's based on the idea that God's laws are the height of perfection and the full revelation of who he is. And by keeping those laws, we are elevated. We are brought to a higher spiritual plane. We help bring redemption to the earth. So since God gave a command, don't eat, to eat it is a violation of a command. And to violate a command in Judaism is to commit the ultimate sin in terms of disobeying God. So, yeah, that would be more the liberal view, and we've become more enlightened. And let me just throw this one other thought out to you. I meditate on it, on these early chapters in Genesis a lot over the years, and thought about, okay, Adam and Eve, before the fall, they understood issues of right and wrong. They understood certain things, and yet they didn't have knowledge of good and evil. What does that mean? Well, you have that phrase elsewhere in the Bible, Deuteronomy 1, Isaiah 7, about someone that's just a child and doesn't understand the difference between these things. So you can put two little babies next to each other on changing tables, a baby boy and a baby girl. They're completely oblivious to the fact that they're sexual beings. They're completely oblivious to the fact that they're both naked. They're completely oblivious if one is dark skin, one is light skin. They're completely oblivious that they have that total innocence. And it struck me that Adam and Eve, before the fall, were perfect, fully mature human beings with brilliant intellects, and yet had that childlike innocence. That's what's striking. And by sinning and eating of the tree they were commanded not to eat of, they fell into the state in which we find ourselves today. Hey, thank you for the question. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Thanks for joining us today. 866-348-7884 is the number to call. Before I go to the phones, just wanted to take you into my world a little bit, some of the stuff we deal with in social media on a daily basis. Some years ago, I responded to a real way out video by a fellow who goes by the name of Brother Nathaniel, a Jewish man who became Russian Orthodox and who is not a particular lover of the state of Israel or Jewish tradition or Judaism. Anyway, so I interacted with one of his videos. We asked him to come on the air, but he wasn't interested in doing that. So someone posted this in response. Brother Nathaniel is the best. I have heard you speak. You are sneaky and manipulative. A Zionist shill. There you go. That explains it, friends. I'm paid by the Zionists. Sneaky and manipulative. Yeah, that's it. Never tell you what I'm really thinking. Never speak straight, forthright. No, don't do that. And then this Christian activist, that's the name on Twitter. I've since blocked them. They post this. Charisma has gone over to the dark side. This article is a pro-Israel article. It's so full of lies and mistruths. If this is U.S. Christianity, the nation is totally stuffed. And then it's got this post, think Israel is our friend and ally. And it's got a quote that was attributes from Kevin Barrett, PressTV.com, allegedly from Prime Minister Netanyahu. Netanyahu's real feelings about America were revealed in a secretly tape-recorded conversation in Finks Bar in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, in 1990. Al-Quds is the Arabic way of saying Jerusalem, the holy city. Quote, if we get caught, they'll just replace us with persons of the same cloth, so it doesn't matter what you do. America's a golden calf, and we'll suck it dry, chop it up, and sell it off piece by piece until there's nothing left but the world's biggest welfare state that we will create and control. Why? Because it's God's will, and America's big enough to take the hit so we can do it again and again and again. This is why we do it in countries that we hate. We destroy them very slowly and make them suffer for refusing to be our slaves. Utter, complete nonsense. Nonsense. Can I say it again? Nonsense. Oh, secretly recorded. You can claim anything was secretly recorded. You can claim anything and put any words you want. There's no verification. There's no testing. There is zero evidence for this. And by the way, Press TV, this is Iranian-run TV. I got online to look into it, and basically everybody quoting it are these extreme anti-Semitic websites. So I replied to set the record straight. And Christian activists replied with this. You are relying on Zionist intelligence to start another war? Who is more deluded? Israel is engaged in destabilizing neighbors, supporting ISIS, murdering children, and sinking the odds U.S. ship now and again. Sinking the odd U.S. ship now and again. Read Obama's comments before supporting another murderous Israeli crusade. I responded my last comment to you. You posted a completely bogus, defaming quote about Prime Minister Netanyahu, then heap on further libels here. This is the last tweet you'll send to me. Sad. And when I get nonsense like that, especially from an alleged Christian activist, that's enough to get blocked. You're going to post defaming libels like that. That's enough to get blocked. And this is, you know, typical junk we see on social media every day. How about this one on our YouTube channel? Hitler was a good guy. Jews are parasites who destroy host countries who are foolish enough to allow them entry. Educate yourself about the parasitic Jew. And, of course, that earned an instant block on YouTube for those comments. This is what we deal with 24/7 on social media. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Los Angeles, California. Stephen, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. Just a quick question. I heard a sermon recently, and I'd never heard this before, regarding the Tower of Babel. So Genesis 10 and 11, the pastor was saying that the word Babel really means Babylon, which I'd never heard. So I was just wondering, how do Genesis 10, 5, and 11, 9, how does that work together? Because one says that everybody was separate and speaking different languages, and then it says everyone was together, and that's why God said, we must stop these people from building the tower. They all speak the same language.
Yeah. So just a few comments here. So Genesis chapter 10, verse 5 is jumping ahead. Okay. The coastlands spread, people spread out to their lands. These are Japheth's sons by their clans and their nations. Each group had its own language. And it's jumping ahead in terms of ultimately what happened, but even to their own language could also mean their own dialect. But often you'll have the account, a genealogy will jump way ahead, and then the next chapter will catch back up with things. All right, that's the first thing. But the expression there could even potentially mean their own dialect or their own. Some would even try to argue their own national identity. But in any case, this could just be jumping ahead before the scattering of the peoples and the change of the language in the 11th chapter. The second thing is Babel means Babel, all right? And Babel in Hebrew is Babylon. So when the Bible speaks of Babylon, it speaks of Babel, the same name. So the question is, how it should be understood in Genesis, the 11th chapter. But the Hebrew word for Babylon is Babel. And Babel is then associated with, in Hebrew, Baal, that God Baal'd, he confused the tongues, hence it's called Babel. Actually, it's just a play on words. We know Babel is Bab Elu, the gate of the gods. and that is the name for ancient Babylon. So the biblical writer is just using a play on words, as biblical writers often did. So then within Genesis 11, therefore its name is called, many English translations, Babylon, for there the Lord confused the language. So yeah, Babel is Babylon. That's correct.
So what was the Lord really worried about, I mean, do you think, or what was the concern?
Well, he saw, remember that he destroys the human race in Noah's day because otherwise the earth is going completely corrupt and will destroy itself.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever human beings, either if we live too long and we can practice our wickedness more, or we can all unite together in such a way that our unified evil will be destructive, ultimately we destroy ourselves with our pride and ambition. So when God says, the response to the people, come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves, otherwise we'll be scattered over the face of the earth. And the Lord said, if as one people speak in the same language, they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. So that's the whole thing. Human beings are ultimately going to plan evil. If left to ourselves, we'll ultimately plan and plot evil. If we unite together in doing it and rebelling against God, we destroy ourselves. God has to judge us and wipe us out. So to prevent us, you know, it's like putting a muzzle on a wild dog. It's to prevent us from doing more evil. That's the whole thing he's working against.
Makes perfect sense. Have a great day, Dr. Brown. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you too. Thank you. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Benjamin in Grapevine, Texas. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. Thanks for taking my question. I'm wondering about the language that's used in Genesis when God created everything and saw that it was good and saw that it was very good when he created man. And then he said, it is not good for man to be alone. I'm just struggling with the words that are used there.
Yeah. So it's a great observation that it's good, 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 very good, then not good. So within Adam, the first man created, there is male and female. There is the seed of both within him, even though he's one individual. But everything else God created in terms of living creatures, they were created in pairs so they could be fruitful and multiply. Adam was created alone, and within him the seeds of male and female. That's why God takes out of him the rib or his side, and out of that makes the woman. So the woman comes out of man. So number one, Adam was unique, and the animal world, the world outside of plants and trees and rocks and stones, and in terms of living creatures, so the animal world, fish, birds, he was the only one that was alone, and that was not good. Everybody else had a pair. So it's for companionship, and it's for the ability to reproduce. So it's not good that he stays in that state, but it was never God's intent that he stayed in that state. Rather, by starting there, God then shows us the need of a man for a woman and a woman for a man, and shows us how the two uniquely become one, and shows us how only male and female together can be fruitful and multiply and fulfill God's purposes for the human race. So if you just have man and woman created from the get-go like this, all the important lessons that we learn in Genesis 2, we don't learn about the unity of man and woman, about the purpose of marriage, about the unique role that each one has. And by the way, that role cannot be fulfilled. It's not just a matter of companionship, it's compatibility. That role of Adam being alone, no longer being alone, could not be fulfilled by Adam plus another Adam, all right? That couldn't be the case. Nor did God start out with a polygamous relationship, all right? God did not go to Adam and Eve and Yvette and Yvonne, as I often say. And this way, Adam says, this now is bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, Isha in Hebrew, for she was taken out of man. Hey, friends, we are out of time. But back with you with your questions tomorrow on Line of Fire. You've got questions, we've got answers. Don't forget, today's a great day to stand with us with a one-time gift to help us in Jewish ministry. AskDrBrown.org. Click on Donate.